welcome to a special Briefings Direct Thought Leadership interview series coming to you in conjunction with the Open Group Conference this July in Washington, D.C. I'm Dana Gardner, Principal Analyst at InterArbor Solutions, and I'll be your host throughout these discussions. The conference will focus on how security impacts the enterprise architecture, enterprise transformation, and global supply chain activities in organizations both large and small. Today, we're here on the security front with one of the main speakers at the July 16th conference, Joel Brenner. He's the author of America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. Joel is a former senior counsel at the National Security Agency, where he advised on legal and policy issues relating to network security. Mr. Brenner also currently practices law in Washington, specializing in cybersecurity. Previously, he served on the National Counterintelligence Executive in the office of the Director of National Intelligence and as the NSA's Inspector General. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, the London School of Economics, and Harvard Law School. Joel, welcome to Briefings Direct.
Thanks for being on. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, we hear from your book that came out last September, by the way, and it affirms sort of this notion that the U.S., or at least open Western cultures and societies, are particularly vulnerable to being, pilfered, if you will, through cybercrime, espionage, and dirty corporate tricks. My question is, you know, why wouldn't these same countries be also very adept on the offense at being highly technical? Why are we particularly vulnerable when we should be perhaps most adept at using cyber activities to our advantage?
Let's make a distinction here between the political military espionage that's gone on since pre-biblical times with the economic espionage that's going on now, that in many cases has nothing at all to do with military's defense or political issues. I mean, the other stuff has been going on forever. But what we've seen in the last 15 or so years is a relentless attack, espionage attack, on private companies for reasons having nothing to do with political military affairs or defense. And so the countries that are adept at cyber, but whose economies are relatively undeveloped compared to ours, are a big advantage because they're not very lucrative targets for this kind of thing, and we are. I mean, the Russia, for example, which is paradoxically, while it's one of the most educated, has one of the most educated populations in the world, deeply cultured, has never been able to produce a commercially viable computer chip. We're not going to Russia to steal advanced technology. We're not going to China to steal advanced technology. They're good at engineering. They're good at production. But so far, they've not been good at making themselves into an entrepreneurial culture. And there are also reasons why, you know, that's one just very cynical reason why we don't do economic espionage against the people who are mainly attacking us, which are China, Russia, and Iran. I say attack in the espionage sense. The other reason is that when you're stealing intellectual property, you're that's what you do when you're doing economic espionage. And it's a bedrock proposition of American economic and political strategy around the world to defend the legal regime that protects intellectual property. So we don't do that kind of espionage. Political military stuff, we're real good at.
Well, I guess this begs the question for me, if we're a hyper capitalist society where we have aggressive business practices and we have these very valuable assets to protect, isn't there the opportunity to take the technology and thwart the advances from these other places? So wouldn't our defenses rise to the occasion, and why haven't they?
Well, I think that the answer has a lot to do with the nature of the Internet and its history. The Internet, as a lot of your listeners will know, was developed starting in the late 60s by the predecessor of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, a brilliant operation which produced a lot of cool science over the years. And it was developed with a very limited purpose, and that was to allow the collaboration of geographically dispersed scientists who worked under contract in various universities with the Defense Department's own scientists. It was bringing dispersed brain power to bear. It was a brilliant idea. And the people who invented this, if you talk to them today, they lament the fact that they didn't build a security layer into it, but they thought about it. And it was not going to be used for anything else but this limited purpose in a trusted environment. And so why go to the expense and aggravation of building a lot of security into it? Until 1992, this is really startling. Until 1992, it was against the law to use the internet for commercial purposes, Dana. I mean, this is just amazing to realize. That's 20 years ago. It's a twinkling of an eye in the history of the country's commerce. And that means that, you know, 20 years ago, nobody was doing anything on the internet. 10 years ago, what were you doing on the internet? Dana, buying a book for the first time or something like that, right? That's what I was doing.
Yeah.
And a newspaper, yeah. And in the intervening decade, we've turned this sort of Swiss cheese, cool network, which has brought us dramatic productivity and all, and pleasure, into the backbone of virtually everything we do. International finance, personal finance, command and control of military, manufacturing controls, the controls in our critical infrastructure, all of our communications, virtually all of our activities are either on the internet or exposed to the internet. And it's the same internet that was Swiss cheese. It was Swiss cheese 20 years ago, it's Swiss cheese now. It's easy to spoof identities on it. So this gives a natural and profound advantage to attacks on this network over defense, and that's why we're in the predicament we're in.
Right, and so the Swiss cheese would work in both directions. U.S. corporations, if they were interested, could use the same techniques and approaches to go into companies in China or Russia or Iran, as you pointed out, but they don't have assets that we're interested in. So we're uniquely vulnerable in that regard. But let's also look at this notion of supply chain, because corporations aren't just islands unto themselves. A business is really a compendium of other businesses, products, services, best practices, methodologies, intellectual property that come together to create a value add of some kind. It's not just attacking the end point where that value is extended into the market. It's perhaps attacking anywhere along that value chain. So what are the implications for this notion of the ecosystem vulnerability versus the enterprise vulnerability?
Well, the supply chain problem really is rather daunting for many businesses because supply chains are global now. And it means that the elements of finished products have tremendous numbers of elements that are and inside each element, for example, there's software. Where was it written? And, you know, maybe it was written in Ohio somewhere or Nevada, but by whom? We don't know. There are two fundamental different issues for supply chain, and they depending on the company. One is counterfeiting. That's a bad problem. Somebody's just trying to substitute shoddy goods under your name or somebody's name that you thought you could trust. And that degrades performance and presents real serious liability problems as a result. The other problem is the intentional hooking or compromising of software or chips to do things that they're not meant to do, such as allow back doors and so on in systems so that they can be attacked later. That's the problem that the military, well, the military worries about both problems. That's the problem, that's a big problem for military and for the intelligence services all around the world. And the reason we have the problem is that nobody knows how to vet a computer chip or software to see that it won't do these squirrely things. We can test that stuff to make sure it will do what it's supposed to do. But nobody knows how to test a computer chip reliably or 2 million lines of software reliably to be sure that it won't also do certain things we don't want it to do. You can put it in a sandbox. You can put it in a virtual environment, and you can test it for a lot of things, but you can't test it for everything. It's just impossible. And that is, strategically speaking, in hardware and software, it is the strategic supply chain problem now. That's why we have it.
Right. So as organizations ramp up their security, as they look towards making their own networks more impervious to attack, their data isolated, their applications isolated, they still have to worry about all of the other components and services that come into play, particularly software.
Yeah, if you have a worldwide supply chain, you have to have a worldwide supply chain management system. This is hard, and it means really getting very specific. It includes not only managing a production process, but also the shipment process. A lot of squirrely things happen on loading docks.
Yeah.
That has to be, you have to have a way to not to bring perfect security to that. That's impossible. But to make it really harder to attack your supply chain.
Well, it sounds like, Joel, we also need to reevaluate the notion of cost. So many organizations today, given the economy and the lagging growth, have looked to lower cost procedures, processes, suppliers, materials, and not factoring in the risk and the associated cost around these security issues. Is that a factor that people need to reevaluate costs in the supply chain by factoring in what the true risks are that we're discussing?
Well, it is. But of course, you know, when the CEO and the CFO get together and start to figure this stuff out, they look at, well, what's the return on an investment of additional security? It's very hard to be quantitatively persuasive about that. But I think so. That's one reason why you may see some kinds of production coming back into the United States. How one evaluates that risk depends on the business you're in, and how much risk you can tolerate. I've seen, this is a problem not just for really sensitive kind of hardware and software and special kinds of operations or sensitive activities, but also for just garden variety things. I mean, if you're making titanium screws for orthopedic operations, for example, and you're making them in, I don't want to name any country, but let's just say a country across the Pacific Ocean with a whole lot of people in it, and you could have significant counterfeit problems there. And explaining to somebody that the screw you just put into his spine is really not what it's supposed to be, and you have to have another operation to take it out and put in another one is not a risk a lot of people want to run. So that it, even in things like that that don't involve electronics, you have significant supply chain management issues. It's worldwide. And it's not just, I don't want to suggest this is a problem just in China. That would be unfair.
Right. Let's just visit this notion of what we've seen in other aspects of commerce, which is we really can't lock down the process. We can't know all the information. But what we can do is offer deterrence, perhaps in the form of legal recourse, if something goes wrong. If, in fact, decisions were made that countered contracts or were against certain laws or trade practices, is it practical to look at some of these issues under the business lens and say, well, we'll just sue them, and if we do, that will deter people from doing this again?
Well, I've struggled with the question for a couple of years now. Why is it that liability hasn't played a bigger role in bringing more cybersecurity to our environment? And there are a number of reasons. I mean, we have created liability for the loss of personal information. And so you can quantify that risk. You have a statute that says there's a minimum damage of $500 or $1,000 per person whose identifiable information you lose. You add up the number of files in the breach and how much the lawyers and the forensic guys cost you, and you come up with a calculation of what these things cost. But when it comes to just business risk, not legal risk, and the loss of intellectual property to a company that depends on that intellectual property, it's you have a business risk. You don't have much of a legal risk at this point. You may have a shareholder suit issue, but there hasn't been an awful lot of that kind of litigation so far. So I don't know. I'm not sure that's quite the question you were asking me, Dana. If you want to.
My follow-on to that was going to be, well, where would you go to sue across borders anywhere? Are there any? Is there a Uber regulatory or legal structure across borders to target things like supply chain counterfeit, cyber espionage, mistreatment of business practices?
Depends what borders you're talking about. I mean, the Europeans have such, they have a highly developed legal and liability system. You can bring actions in European courts. So it depends what borders you mean. If you're talking about the border of Russia, very different legal issues you have. China, different legal issues, and different from Russia's as well as from our own. There are increasing number of cases where actions are being brought in China successfully for breaches of intellectual property rights. But you wouldn't say that was the case in Nigeria. You wouldn't say that was the case in a number of other countries where we've had a lot of crime, cyber crime originating from. So there's no one solution here. You have to think in terms of all kinds of layered defenses. They're legal actions one can take sometimes, but the fundamental problem we're dealing with is this inherently porous Swiss cheesy system. And in the long run, we're going to have to begin thinking about the gradual reengineering of the way the internet works, or else this basic dynamic in which lawbreakers have advantage over law-abiding people is not going to go away. I mean, think about the what's happened in cyber defenses over 10 years, how little they've evolved, 10 years or 20 years for that matter. I mean, they almost all require us to know the attack mode or the sequence of code in order to catch it.
Reactive.
That's not a big, we get better at that, but that's a leapfrog business. That's fundamentally the way we do it. And whether we do it at the perimeter or inside or even outside before the attack gets to the perimeter, that's what we're looking for, stuff we've already seen. That's a very poor method of poor strategy for doing security, but that's where we are. And it hasn't changed much in quite a long time, and it's probably not gonna.
Well, why is that the case? Is this not a perfect opportunity for a business-government partnership to come together and re-architect the internet, at least for certain types of business activities, create a two-tier approach, add different levels of security into that. Why hasn't it gone anywhere?
Well, what you are seeing this, beginning to see what I think you're saying, you say different tiers or segments. We're talking about the balkanization of the internet, and I think that's going to happen as more companies demand a higher level of protection, but this again is a cost-benefit analysis. And you're going to see even more balkanization of the internet as you see countries like Russia and China and with some success, imposing more controls over what can be said and done on the internet. That's not going to be acceptable to us. And
notion of public and private. We have public squares.
You can say public and private. That's a way of financing it, though. That's not going to – that doesn't change the nature of the problem. It won't happen all at once. We're not going to abandon the internet. I mean, that would be crazy. Everything depends on it now. You can't do that. It'd be a fairy tale to think of it. But it's going to happen gradually, and there is research going on into that sort of thing right now. But it's also a big political issue.
Yeah, right.
Big political issue.
Let's look at a little slight different tack on this, and we've seen a lot with cloud computing and more businesses starting to go to third-party cloud providers for their applications, their services, data storage, even integration to other business services and so forth. Now, if there's a limited number or at least a finite managed number of cloud providers and they can institute the proper security and perhaps take advantage of certain networks within networks, then wouldn't that hypothetically make a cloud approach more secure, more managed than every man for himself, which is what we have now in enterprises and small to medium-sized businesses?
I think the short answer is yes. The small and many medium-sized businesses will achieve greater security by basically contracting it out to what are called cloud providers. And that's because managing the patching of vulnerabilities and other aspects and encryption is beyond what most small businesses and many medium-sized businesses can do or are willing to do or can do cost-effectively. Big businesses in the cloud, I think that just depends on how good the big business's own management of IT is, as to whether it's an improvement or not. Mm-hmm. But there are some problems with the cloud. People talk about security, but there are different aspects of it. You and I have been talking just now about security, meaning the ability to prevent somebody from stealing or corrupting your information. But availability is another aspect of security. And by definition, putting everything in one remote place reduces robustness by definition. Because if you lose that connection, you lose everything. Consequently, it seems to me that backup issues are really critical for people who are going to the cloud. Are you going to rely on your cloud provider to provide the backup? Are you going to rely on the cloud provider to provide all of your backup? Are you going to go to a second cloud provider? Are you going to keep some information copied in-house? I mean, what would happen if your information's good, but you can't get to it? That means you can't get to anything anymore. So that's another aspect of security people need to think through.
Right. Okay, we're almost out of time, Joel, but I wanted to get a little bit into the sense of metrics of measurement of success or failure. How do you know you're doing the right thing? How do you know that you're protecting? How do you know that you've gone far enough to ameliorate the risks?
This is really hard. And, you know, if somebody steals your car tonight, Dana, and you go out to the curb or the garage in the morning, you know it's not there. You know it's been stolen. When somebody steals your algorithms, your formulas, your secret processes, you still got them. You don't know they're gone until 3 or 4 years later, somebody in Central China or Siberia is opening a factory and selling stuff into your market that you thought you were going to be selling, and whoa, that's your stuff. And then maybe you go back and realize, oh, that incident 3 or 4 years ago, maybe that's when that happened. Maybe that's when I lost it. So you don't even know necessarily when things have been stolen, and most companies don't do a good job at that. They're so busy trying to find out what's coming into their network, they're not looking at what's going out. So that's one reason this stuff is hard to measure. Another, as I said, what's the return on the investment? It's very, very tough. And on the other hand, let me just say this, that there are lots of things where business people have to make important judgments in the face of risks and opportunities they can't quantify, but we do it. I mean, we're right to want data whenever we can get it, because data generally mean we can make better decisions. But we make decisions about investment in R&D all the time without knowing what the return on that investment is going to be. And we certainly don't know what the return on a particular R&D expenditure is going to be. But we make that because people are convinced that if they don't make it, they'll fall behind. They'll be selling yesterday's products tomorrow. Why is it that we have a we do have a bias toward that kind of risk when it comes to opportunity, but not when it comes to defense. And I think we need to be candid about our own biases in that regard. But I don't have a satisfactory answer to your question, and nobody else does either. This is one where we can't quantify that answer.
It sounds as if people need to have a healthy dose of paranoia to tide them over across these areas. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, let's say skepticism.
Okay.
People need to understand, without actually being paranoid, that life is not always what it seems, and that there are people who are trying to steal things from us all the time, and that we need to protect ourselves, and that I think in many companies you don't see a willingness to do that, but that varies a great deal from company to company. Things are not always what they seem. That is not how we Americans approach life. We're trusting folks, which is why this is a great country to do business in and live in. But we are having our pockets picked, and it's time we understood that.
And as I pointed out earlier, this picking of pockets is not just on our block, but could be any of our suppliers, partners, or other players in our ecosystem. Their pockets get picked. It ends up being our problem, too.
Yeah, I describe this risk in my book, America the Vulnerable, at great length. And in my practice here at Cooley, in my law firm, I deal with this every day. I find myself, Dana, giving briefings to business people that 5 or let alone 10 or 20 years ago, you wouldn't have given to anybody who wasn't a diplomat or a military person going abroad for risk outside of the country. And now it's in this kind of cyber pilferage is an aspect of daily commercial life, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, very good. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. We've been talking with Joel Brenner. He's the author of America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. And as a lead-in to his open group presentation on July 16th on cybersecurity, Joel and I have been exploring the current cyber crime landscape and what can be done to better understand the threat and work against it. This special Briefings Direct discussion comes to you in conjunction with the Open Group Conference from July 16th to 20th in Washington, D.C. You'll hear more from Joel and others on ways that security and supply chain management can be improved at the conference. I want to thank you, Joel, for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I certainly look forward to your presentation in Washington, and I encourage our readers and listeners to attend the conference to learn more. This is Dana Gardner, Principal Analyst at Inter Arbor Solutions, your host and moderator for these thought leadership interviews. Thanks again for listening, and come back next time.